This podcast is kindly supported by Resolute Investment Managers, Inc. and 91 Asset Management. Resolute Investment Managers, Inc. is a diversified multi-affiliate asset management platform that partners at more than 30 best-in-class affiliated and independent investment managers. It offers a unique platform that delivers strategic value through the full suite of distribution, operational, and administrative services available to affiliates and partners. 91 Asset Management is a global asset manager with emerging markets roots that brings a different perspective to active and sustainable investing.
I think that marketing, first of all, is not evil. And I think what I really like about marketing is that when you do it right, it is actually beneficial. It's a combination of storytelling, creativity, psychology, science, measuring, repeating, and then discovering what works better and what doesn't work as well. And ultimately, you're a matchmaker, and I really enjoy that. And financial services marketing is so difficult because the hero obviously is a person with an unmet need. In 9 times out of 10, what financial services marketers need to realize is that the people who are most likely to respond to them and engage with them are people who are going through a change.
Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Rick Weisinger, who is Chief Marketing and Communications Officer at Moneta and a veteran of financial services marketing. He previously held roles at Brightworth and Craneware. Welcome, Rick. Thanks for joining me today.
It's good to see you, Ethan. Thank you for having me.
Well, we've had the pleasure of working together now for over a year at Moneta, and I've always been intrigued by the evident joy and fascination that you derive from marketing and communication. And I wanted to take this opportunity to tap into some of that so that you can share some of your wisdom with all of us and maybe get us to see the world through a bit of a marketing lens. So that's the goal here. No pressure, but I look forward to having a chat. But let's start with your background. So, you know, I know that you have an interest as a musician. It wasn't always marketing that drove you. Can you talk us through your background, where you grew up, and your early interests?
Well, I haven't changed a lot over the years. I realized that coming into this is that where I started is sort of where I ended up. I actually grew up in Florida, of all places. And as a kid, I was always interested in the same things I'm by and large interested in now, which was art, music, writing, and the outdoors. And since then, I've really honed in on those and continued to be active in all of those ever since. And as far as how in the world I ended up down the path of marketing, it really is to enter it the way I entered it, at least. It was the combination of art and music and writing and just communication, because I loved writing, I loved talking, I loved making art. And I really sort of stumbled into it. When I first went to university, I had no idea what I was going to do. And I still remember it was my freshman year. For some reason, I think I was in a business class and we went to an ad agency. And I think I was dimly aware that ad agencies existed. I mean, I knew somebody had to do Campbell soup cans besides Andy Warhol. And so we went to an agency and I got talking to the art director. And I said, so what is it exactly you did? And he described it. I don't remember how he described it, but it was fascinating and compelling. And I said, because I was a very rude 18-year-old, I said, so you can actually make a living doing this? He said, yeah, if you're good at it, you can make 6 figures. I just thought, that's the job for me. And from then on, there was just no turning back. That's what I wanted to do.
Well, I can certainly see it traces to the creative instincts and communication. And it's a really the wide open landscape of what you could do. But you say you're a self-confessed kind of marketing geek or marketing nerd. I'm not sure how you describe geeking out in it. What is it that you love about marketing today?
I think my view of it might come across as a little Pollyanna-ish, but I think that marketing, first of all, is not evil. I think that people tend to think of it. Well, to rewind a little bit, at a previous position, I was vice president of corporate marketing, and I've always joked that those are the three most disliked phrases in all of corporate America. You're from corporate, your vice president, and you do marketing. I mean, it's just the trifecta of horribleness. But I feel like marketing genuinely should be a form of matchmaking. I'm sure that there are people who will look at marketing as something that can be coercive or manipulative, but I really feel like it is connecting an unmet need with a valuable service or product. I'm looking around me right now, and on the other side of my computer screen, you alluded earlier to music, I see a guitar. I never would have found this guitar if it hadn't been marketed effectively. I absolutely love it. It's a strange brand name. It's not easy to find, but I found it because it was marketed well. It was marketed to a likely buyer. They told a compelling story. It wasn't all about the features, but it was more about the story of the people who made the guitar and the care that they put into it. That resonated with me. They targeted me very, very effectively, and it spurred me to action. And I think what I really like about marketing is that when you do it right, it is actually beneficial. It's a combination of storytelling, creativity, psychology, science, measuring, repeating, and then discovering what works better and what doesn't work as well. And ultimately, you're a matchmaker, and I really enjoy that.
It's really interesting, that perspective, and it ties very well. We're going to talk about some of your values in marketing, but I want to just sort of put a flag on something to come back to later around this distinction between wants and needs. And obviously, a lot of marketing is around things people do not need, and perhaps the role it can have in reinforcing biases, et cetera, or simply unrealistic representations of, say, the human form.
I think that comes back to, and I'll warn you and the listeners already, that I'm not the biggest Star Wars geek, but they're the most wonderful metaphors imaginable because they're so universal for many deep reasons. I think George Lucas was a genius with this, but it can be a force for good, and it can also really be a force for evil. I mean, I do see that all the time, and it leads to the question of whether media and marketing are a reflection or even an amplification of what society wants, or whether it is driving what society wants. And I really think you can go both ways, and I wish I had the answer. I think that ultimately it can be an incredibly powerful tool, and it's like almost any tool, the way it's wielded and what you achieve with it is based on the people using it. I think that if you find somebody with, I would say, questionable morality, they can use marketing to do terrible things, to prey on people's insecurities. I mean, that's the most obvious. It's been said over and over again, and I think it's been demonstrated through research, that people are more likely to respond to a marketing message that threatens their happiness and their status quo more than a marketing message that promises them a potential better future. I personally don't do that because of the ethics and because the companies with whom I've chosen to work don't do battle in those sorts of arenas. But my brother is an attorney, for example. He can use that for good and he can use that for evil. I like to think that he's used it for good. He's a highly ethical person. But I mean, it's like you buy a shovel, you can use that to dig a garden and plant vegetables, or you can use it to whack somebody over the head. But unfortunately, I think it's ultimately a moral question, and that marketing is the tool, but marketing itself is largely agnostic. It's a people problem.
With much power comes much responsibility. I suppose when you think about right. that in terms of the market, the power of the marketer. And building on that into some other of your maybe core values around marketing, and an example of what I'm getting at, if, for example, we had Maggie Lowry here, who was previously at Hootsuite. She was on one of our series, and she cautions against random acts of marketing, around that marketing had to be joined up. It had to be intentional and linked to a mission or corporate values. How, any other values approach or beliefs you have besides some of what we've already discussed?
Well, I love the random acts of marketing. I steal that quote all the time myself. Again, at the risk of sounding a little Pollyanna-ish, the core value for me is that it's always about the buyer or the consumer. And note that I don't say the audience. It's about the buyer or the consumer. An audience is an abstract. It's simply a way of putting together some data points to put together something like a buyer persona that's very, very general. But at the end of the day, if you can't find some genuine empathy, some core, I don't want to say need, but a core way in which you can benefit your consumers, then you're going to have a very, very difficult time marketing. Because what people do all the time, and we've all seen it, and we've all been in organizations who've done it, and I know people who've watched themselves do it, and they know they're doing it wrong, but they can't help themselves, is that you reach for communicating about yourself. You start talking about your own greatness, your own features. It's either your credentials, or the number of customers you have, or the number of calculations you can do per second, or the price difference. Those are all ultimately valuable, but that's by and large noise in the minds of the consumer. Because what the consumer, what the buyer has, is that they would like to have a better life. Ultimately, you have to realize, I'd like to have a better life. And if you're working at a company that stands for something a little bit more than just extracting money from your buyers, then you know that you can improve somebody's life. And so you need to continually remind yourself and focus on that. And the second, I think, biggest, I don't know if it's value, it's somewhere between a value and a tactic that I would say has to follow that, is that once you understand how you can improve somebody's life, you then have to understand their story and tell their story. And I think that every marketer should be familiar with Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces, who was sort of popularized the whole idea of the hero's journey, which is just something that has been handed down across civilizations, across locations, since the beginning of storytelling. And it's always very similar. There's a hero. He has a challenge or a quest that has to be overcome. They can't do it on their own, whoever this hero is, whether it's a group or an individual. They need a guide. The guide, and this is where the Star Wars comes in, is not Luke. Luke is a hero. The guide is always Obi-Wan. The guide comes in, confirms that, yes, indeed, you do have a challenge. I empathize. I understand the challenge. I've helped others with this challenge. And then you do bring them to the point where they have the ability to triumph. But you have to remember that your buyer or your audience or your consumer, they're the hero. In all of these stories, there's only one hero, and it's not you. Sorry, marketer, firm, brand, the wonderful corporation of America, you are not the hero.
I love that. And how much do you think companies are getting that now? That's a great, we're recording this at the end of February. We've had the Super Bowl. We've had, you know, which is the advertising or TV advertising extravaganza. Look at, you've been watching marketing now in many forms over decades. Have you seen that shifting, that people are getting that?
I think so. I honestly think so. I think one thing that I'm encouraged by recently is there's a little bit of a resurgence of both humor and creativity in marketing. And I know we're really talking about the messaging, and messaging is the most exciting part of marketing. The hard work is, of course, the research, the media buying, the analytics, the A-B testing, et cetera. But in terms of the message, I'm seeing recently in some amazing ads, I've seen more humanity, more recognition that the buyer, the audience, the consumer might be a little bit quirky, that they might be able to laugh a little bit at themselves, and even better, that the brand might laugh a little bit at themselves. For example, I won't name names, but there is a company that does, I'd say, a fairly progressive consumer packaged good product. It's food, and they've been very, very active in Threads lately, the social platform that's been touted as an alternative to Twitter or X. And they have the most unbelievably irreverent social media manager who will go and directly quote some people who are being snarky on their thing and laughing a little bit at it and saying something like, well, can I quote you on that? We're going to put that on the package next time, things like that. I mean, they're absolutely hilarious. And what I love about it is that by not taking, I won't say they're not taking their brand seriously, but the brand itself understands that they have to have some humor, some humanity, and they're gaining incredible traction in social media by doing that.
And of course, this will evolve too. I mean, it could be evolving with our cultural waves of changing, and we may take ourselves more seriously again and frown upon that. But that's the fascinating part. And translating that now into financial services marketing, because not only is that another area that you geek out about, but you're very good at, and you are giving a keynote speech at various events and look forward to all of that. Tell us how that translates into financial services, which is probably known as an area where there have been some sharks and mis-selling, et cetera. So who's the hero of that story?
Well, in financial services marketing, it's so difficult because the hero obviously is a person with an unmet need. And I really like to feel in 9 times out of 10, what financial services marketers need to realize is that the people who are most likely to respond to them and engage with them are people who are going through a change. They're at a transition or a pivot point, or I don't want to say a crisis. It can be either a crisis or an opportunity. But I've told quite a few people that, look, if you're not worried about money, if your family, your kids, the causes you care about, your friends are okay, you know you're going to retire okay, you're not worried that anything's going away, you've got millions in gold bullion under the bed and everything's great, you're not going to be responsive to any financial services message, no matter how funny, compelling, sexy, interesting, loaded with credentials. It's not going to happen. But the moment there's any sort of either opportunity or a threat to either better your situation or to threaten your situation, that's where the message comes into play. And the message really needs to be, going back to my hero's journey, is that your audience has the potential to be a hero there. It's a cliche, but every threat is also an opportunity. You've really got an opportunity to overcome this and maybe even come out better. And so, once again, I'm going back to my key word for all of this is Pollyanna-ish. But I really believe that by offering the potential to look at both an opportunity and a threat as simply two different varieties of opportunities and come out better, you can do that. And I mean, some of the ways that you do that are through radical honesty, frankness, a bit of humility, and demonstrating a bit of empathy. For example, the go-to, the playbook for years, and I think it really is changing in the last 5 or 6 years, I've seen it start to change, is that financial services, and in particular, let's say financial advisors, wealth management, RIAs, et cetera, will come in with their strength, their power. We deliver this. We do that. We have this many credentials. We have this many advisors. We have this many branches. We have this much in assets under management. That's not compelling. That's not what is top of mind for somebody who's facing an opportunity or a transition. What's top of mind is, and I went through this exercise with a lot of advisors, actually. I went through an exercise with them where I said, don't talk to me about you. Come back to me and give me a list of the top 5 questions people ask in your initial meeting. What are their top 5 concerns? The concerns were nothing like what most people advertise. The concerns were, when is it okay for me to sell my business? How do I know what it's worth? How do I know if I'm getting ripped off? Am I going to be able to retire? Can I send my kids to college? What do I do about my aging parents? What do I do about making sure my family makes good decisions once I'm gone? I'm going to leave them a lot of money. And in this particular case, I helped them quite literally, not even metaphorically, make those the headlines. That was it. I mean, it was very, very simple, but at the same time, it was very, very radical, because what they would want to do before is comprehensive wealth management and financial planning for individuals and families of means to help them achieve their life goals. I mean, that just puts me to sleep. Everybody says that. You're just one more voice out there saying the same thing that everybody's saying. And it just takes it, once again, it's going back to the hero. Who's the hero? It's not you. Stop making yourself the hero. The hero is the person whom you can help.
Really interesting points. And I'm just going to bring in some things that have occurred to me just as I hear from other, from either investment advisors, et cetera, who speak a little bit about the client's desire to have someone who helped them navigate uncertainty. think of, like, say, car ads. There's some cars that won't mention names, but it's from a certain Nordic country that would always advertise its safety. It's not its advertising that it goes faster or it's a faster acceleration, but it is its safety, and it's built like a cage and it'll protect your family. And that was that car's USP for decades, maybe still is. So I think having someone help navigate uncertainty is one thing. And another thing you haven't said, and maybe this is a misconception, is it doesn't seem like there's anybody is necessarily concerned about the status of the advisor that manages their money or the group that manages their money. I would think that's something maybe a misconception, because money being such a private thing, do people choose advisors based on the ability to advertise and show off to their friends that they're using X advisor?
I think that there are some who do that, but I'm not an advisor, so I can't answer for advisors. But I have found in my own experience that advisors and advisory firms sometimes have a little higher estimation of their brand equity than the broader market does. I mean, everybody knows a handful, three or four big, big names that spend billions on advertising. I mean, I've known advisors from quite a few different RIAs. And if you go to a different part of the country and you talk to them at a conference or you're traveling or something like that, they're like, who? Whereas if you go back to their city or their state or possibly their region, oh yeah, I'm familiar with them. But I feel like, yes, in your geographic area, I think that's probably a selling point. But outside of that geographic area, I would say check your preconceptions at the door. I do feel that one area in which a lot of smaller firms are remiss, and I can understand why they are, because it's expensive, but I've worked a couple of times with companies who do have the budget to do it, is market research before you go out there. That's where you can get some of these answers. For example, and I'll try to anonymize this as much as possible, but I was working with a large international firm. This was on the agency side before I moved over to client side. And they did advertising in all over Europe and North America. And they had always sold their key product, which was both a service and hardware based on a feature set. So I worked with a brand research agency, and they spent well into six figures in about 9 months on doing market research. And what they came back with at the end of the day, and this research was really sort of what started me down this philosophy of the hero's journey, is that they were marketing into the hospital world and the physicians, and it infuriated the product managers for this company. But what the physicians were interested in at the end of the day was that they wanted to help some people out. They wanted to feel really good about helping some people out. And then they wanted to go home and not worry anymore. And they would be quizzed about, well, how many calculations per minute and how many dashboards, how many feature sets and how many inches of this and how many pounds of this? They showed polite interest in that. But the real interest was that at the end of the day, they'd really help some people out. And it led to what I thought was a pretty successful campaign. But it was the research that did that. And I would think that financial firms, if you can possibly do the research, even if all you can really do is, say, a client advisory council, where you get your ideal mix of clients and just run some things by them, you're going to hear things that you wouldn't hear if you only talked amongst yourselves. So do the research.
Spend the money. Yeah. Difficult to do. Easy to say, difficult to do, but that makes a lot of sense. And wanted to talk a little bit about the next frontier of marketing before we turn to reflections. So you recently were at the Cannes Lions Festival with other CMOs from around the world, some of the biggest brands there. I'd love to know what you perceive as being on the next frontier of marketing. And maybe we can touch on the role of social media marketing here too.
As I recall, there were really three major topics at Cannes. And of course, the world in general moves so fast that those may not be the same topics at the next Cannes in June. The first was performance marketing versus brand marketing, which I find very, very interesting. The second that everybody was talking about was AI. I don't even want to address that. It is in such flux. Trust me, on my home computer, not my work computer. I have every imaginable AI tool. I'm making disturbing videos and strange essays and all of that just to get into it. I'm digging into it. I'm going to leave that for the next generation to figure out. But the third, and this one, I actually pulled up some notes because my memory is not good enough to remember this. Absolutely fascinating was that it was the impact of businesses that stand for something bigger than themselves. And it's something that's usually dismissed as a little bit of a woo-woo, you've been smoking bad granola sort of thing. But the results were amazing. There were a lot of very large advertisers. I was in this group, the CMO Accelerator. It was just CMOs. And they were, I mean, people from Procter & Gamble, Apple, I mean, everyone you can think of. And they showed some devastatingly powerful television spots and even print spots that were devastating from an emotional perspective. And you had a whole room full of 28 CMOs, literally everybody weeping at the end of a couple of them. They were so powerful. But what's fascinating, this is more of a CFO-CEO impact, Bain & Company did a study of firms that in their marketing and communication adhered to seven, and I'm sorry, I can't quote them, but they were tenets of ESG principles. And the ones that marketed and communicated with the highest adherence to these ESG principles reported five times the growth of those who were in the bottom 20% of adhering to those principles. And I don't think Bain & Company is known as being a warm and fuzzy, weak on the data, tree-hugging sort of organization. They're fairly hard-boiled. And for them to come back with quantifiable data about that, I just thought was absolutely fascinating, and it made me want to dig more. And so I've been digging more, and there are a lot of numbers that really do support that consumers across broad swaths respond to standing for something bigger than simply a transaction. Yes, they want an effective product. They want a product at a good price. They want a product that will meet their pain points. But there are probably a lot of vendors, a lot of firms that can do that. But the product that stands for something bigger than themselves, ideally something that the consumer themselves believes in, so that's where it comes back to research, know your audience. You don't particularly want to stand for something that your audience hates. Nonetheless, when you stand for something bigger, the business results are potentially powerful.
Fascinating. And it really comes back to values, because I think the consumer's values, perhaps, what is that thing bigger than themselves that resonates for them, that they identify with? And before you finish on marketing, I can't not ask you about some marketing snafus or clear marketing errors or fails. And again, this gets to sometimes misreading the audience or and the Bud Light type of a debacle, where maybe a brand tried to stand for something that was actually controversial and ended up having people resign and backfiring and maybe have damaging of the brand. Do you think that's inevitable? There are going to be some fails along the way. Is there anything that maybe could have been done better in some of these obvious brand errors?
I don't want to throw a lot of shade at the marketing team at Bud Light. They've had an amazing track record over the years. That was one that I won't even say in hindsight. I would even say in foresight, you could have looked at that one. And in my opinion, and again, I don't think I'm probably going to get the CMO job for AB InBev anytime soon. But when you're looking at a brand that has an extremely broad, I mean, unbelievably broad audience, I think that deciding to align yourself with a message and a set of values that are both polarizing and only appealing to a minority subset of that broad audience, that's a strange mistake to make. Once again, know your audience. But it is inevitable, because one thing that people always ask for, and I can understand why they ask for it, even though it kind of rubs me the wrong way. So people want to break through the clutter. It's break through the clutter, break through the clutter. Well, to break through the clutter, you have to do something different. You have to stand out, and you have to take some chances. It's just patently obvious that you can't break through the clutter by playing it safe. So there will be a few of the snafus. I mean, I'll tell you one that's funny because it's so far in the background and it's really more of an operational snafu. But at the same time, it just shows the kind of blindness that marketers can come up with. I was working for an agency. Agency no longer exists, so we can laugh about it now. And I was not the creative director. The creative director, brilliant man, love him to death, came up with an idea for sending out to clients of an agricultural company a mailer that had a little treat inside. The product being advertised was something that got rid of something called suckers. And a sucker is something that a cotton farmer does not want on their plants. So he inserted a lollipop inside of each mailer. What he hadn't researched was the fact that when you bulk mail them, they go through a mail sorting machine that puts it through giant rollers to put a little barcode at the bottom. So we had thousands of large-scale agricultural companies getting a crushed, smeared hunk of sugar and a mangled stick inside of a card. It was embarrassing. I don't think it did a lot for retaining that account. You know, you can laugh now, but heads rolled.
But I am laughing. I'm just imagining what a mess that was.
But he tried something different. You know, he tried something different. I mean, Ethan, I'll ask you. I mean, I'm sure because you've got a better perspective on this, having a foot on two continents, I'm sure you've seen American brands try to get into Ireland or the UK or the EU with just an incredible misfire.
For sure. I mean, the absolute cultural awareness is kind of 101. I mean, obviously that way I would hope with the global agencies is front and center of their, you know, whether it's not using words that offend, gestures that offend, and just being aware of the nuances of each country. But yeah, it can be amusing when they fail for sure. Well, just want to move to some personal reflections because we've had it. This has been a great discussion on marketing. Setbacks or challenges? We're talking about other people's snafus. Was there anything that maybe in your career you learned any lessons from, marketing or otherwise?
A lot of them have been really more about personal lessons in terms of eventually moving through management and leadership roles. I think the best one that I ever learned is through a wonderful coach that I know. He actually used to worked in Ireland for many years for a major financial institution. I should probably introduce you to do that after the podcast. But he's also been an executive coach and a personal coach. And I think of him as something of a philosopher. And the most valuable thing that he taught me is that one of the biggest mistakes we can make is simply attribution error. And by attribution error, I mean confusing correlation with causation, but also doing it in terms of people's behaviors and people's wants. Let's say if you're a marketer and you're looking at a client, whether it's an internal client, say a team, or an external client, and they're asking something that seems unreasonable, people's first defense or their first reaction is a bit like the reaction if you're driving down the highway, you're on your way to work, somebody swings around behind you, cuts you off, weaves between two more cars, and then goes down an exit. Your first reaction, and it would be your first reaction if a client asks you for something unreasonable, is, man, if I had rocket launchers on my steering wheel right now, and I'm quoting a song here, somebody would pay. I can't believe, and it's going to ruin your day. And as this coach told me, he said, what if you got to work and somebody told you that their friend driving that kind of car had just found out that their partner was in labor. Her blood pressure had spiked. They were in danger of losing the baby and the mother. And he had to drive like a maniac to get there. You would suddenly feel like the worst person in the world. You would suddenly feel like, I wish I'd pulled over. I wish I would have called a police escort for that guy. And it's the same thing when people ask you for anything unreasonable in marketing. Let's say they ask you for something that, well, I want to sell these features anyway. I don't care what you say, I want to sell these features anyway. You can get your back up, you can react, you can take a confrontational attitude, or you can ask. You can say, well, this is obviously really important to you. I'd like to hear more. I'd like to understand why this is important to you. How's this worked for you in the past? have you seen it work? Maybe we can take some of these elements and make it work and come to a more collaborative position.
Well, amazing wisdom there. And we've kind of answered the key people, the words of wisdom, as well as the lessons learned all in one. Rick, this has been our own personal keynote from the Church of Marketing. And I know I've taken a lot away from this. Any words of wisdom you want to leave us with? This is the craft of the taglines and the words to live by. So anything that you know, has really made an impression on you that sums up maybe a creed or motto as to how you see the world?
That's a really big question. I would say it's a combination of be a little curious, know who you're talking to, and don't be afraid to have just a little bit of fun and push it and break the clutter. And once again, I will share one that I think summarizes all of that. It's the favorite piece of work that I've ever done in my life. And it was when I was working at a small agency and the client was Highland Brewing Company. They make a wonderful beer. I heartily endorse it. At the time, they were very, very small. They've since expanded. And so Highland, Scottish, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't have much money. And so what I did, I listened to them. They were incredibly proud. They were incredibly proud of the fact that they made genuine Scottish-style ales. They made a great brown ale in particular. They had a niche audience of real enthusiasts, and they weren't afraid to be a little bit different. So what I ended up doing was that I made a poster, and it showed five guys at a urinal. Four of them are wearing gray suits. You only see them from behind, cropped from shoulder down to knees. One of them, toward the middle, is wearing a kilt, and he's holding bagpipes. The tagline was, just a wee bit different. And it was fun. It was direct. It was honest. I listened to them. And hats off to them, or tam o'shanters off to them, or whatever. They weren't afraid to do something a little daring, a little different. Unlike Bud Light, I think they really, really knew their audience. They could get away with something crazy. And it worked.
Wonderful. Well, you've taken them on a tour from the era of Mad Men right into a men's urinal. So I think that's probably a good place to bring it to an end. Thank you so much, Rick. This has been a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks for coming here and sharing some of your wisdom with us.
Well, thank you, Ethan. It's always a pleasure.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring professionals and their stories, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.